For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Keith Hubbard has a Star Talk report that highlights the Leonid meteor shower. Stephanie Phillips visits Diana K. Weiner and John W. Story at their Never Sink Plant Company. In her segment, Now You Know, you'll hear a descriptive conversation about a variety of garden designs and succulent plants. All of that coming up on today's Farm and Country. But first, news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. There are growing calls from both parties on Capitol Hill to release a report from the House Ethics Committee that investigated former Congressman Matt Gaetz. The panel launched a probe into the Florida Republican on allegations of sex trafficking and drug use. Republican Congressman Tom Emmer of Minnesota says he doesn't believe anything substantial would be revealed.
When it comes to the Ethics Committee, that is a committee that is nonpartisan. It has the same number of Republicans and Democrats on it. They will make that decision, and it doesn't matter what the Speaker says or what I say.
Speaker Mike Johnson is urging the House panel not to release the report. Gaetz resigned from Congress this week after President-elect Donald Trump nominated him to serve as the nation's next Attorney General. Immigrant advocacy groups are organizing in response to potential mass deportations expected under the next administration. Yvette Fernandez with the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
Trump has vowed to carry out, quote, the largest mass deportation in history. Leo Murrieta with Make the Road Action Nevada recalled the 1954 military-style operation to remove thousands of Mexicans who had crossed into the U.S. in search of work.
Our communities have seen the failure of state agencies, the failure of municipalities, hospitals, and others in law enforcement when they have betrayed immigrant communities in the past and mass deportations have happened.
Advocacy groups are calling for local and state agencies not to share information with federal immigration enforcement officers. For NPR News, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
The Israeli military this week announced a small expansion of an area in southern Gaza it has designated as a humanitarian zone for civilians to shelter in the war against Hamas. But elsewhere in central Gaza, the Israeli military struck a camp where displaced Palestinians live. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has this report.
It's dark, and in Al-Burej camp, tents are on fire. Amid the heat and the smoke, people run in panic, screaming as they search for their loved ones. At least four people, including a nine-year-old girl, died in the Israeli drone strike. A new report by a UN special committee that investigates Israeli human rights practices in the occupied territories documents the intensity of the Israeli military's war with Hamas in Gaza. It finds that by December 10 last year, the Israeli army had already used over 25,000 tons of explosives across the Gaza Strip, the equivalent, it says, of two nuclear bombs. The Israeli military did not immediately reply to NPR's request for comment. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. What does it take to run a cannabis farm?
I'm a very stubborn person, so I've not given up on the cannabis. It's just been a wild ride.
And are cannabis products as safe as they seem?
If people want to consume recreationally, fine, but they don't even realize that they are being manipulated with very high concentrations of THC.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. On today's show, Stephanie Phillips visits Diana K. Wiener and John W. Story at their Never Sink Plant Company. In this segment, Now You Know, we'll hear a descriptive conversation about succulent plants and a variety of garden designs. If you appreciate their work, you may want to take advantage of their greenhouse sale. But first, here is Keith Hubbard with this week's Star Talk Report. Thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
And Country. I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. From now until the end of November, the Leonid meteor shower will be occurring. The best time to see the meteor shower will be in the late night and early morning hours. At that time, the sickle will be high in the southeast. The best place to view the shower will be a rural location away from city lights. During the shower's peak, which will be the evening of Sunday into the morning of Monday this year, you can expect to see 10 to 15 meteors per hour. The bright waning gibbous moon will wash out some of the meteors this year. The meteors will come from Comet Temple-Tuttle. It was discovered independently by William Temple in December 1865 and Horace Tuttle in January 1866. It was then lost for 100 years before being rediscovered in 1965. Comet Temple-Tuttle orbits the Sun every 33 years, with its last approach coming in 1998. The Leonids have produced some amazing displays in the past. In 1966, thousands of meteors per minute fell within a 15-minute span. The meteor shower of 1833 was known as the Night the Stars Fell. That night, an estimated 100,000 meteors per hour rained down on Earth. The Leonid meteor shower is occurring now through the end of November, with the peak night being this Sunday into Monday. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Good morning. This is Stephanie Phillips with Now You Know for Farm and Country. I'm going to be speaking with Master Gardener Diana Wiener and her husband, John Story. Diana could speak about many types of plants, but now she's focused on succulents, which she sells from her greenhouse in Neversink. Let's hear about it. Diana, please introduce yourself.
My husband, John Story, and I own a small greenhouse business in Neversink, New York. We have 2.5 acres of gardens, 2 cats, and a great community of friends.
This is John Story. I'm the husband of Diana Wiener, and together we sell lots of unusual plants out of our greenhouse in Neversink.
I just had a tour, and there are certainly some unusual plants there. Where did you grow up?
We moved to Neversink in 2012 when I took a job with Sullivan Renaissance. I grew up in Mamaroneck in Westchester County. John grew up in Freehold, New York, in his family's farm and garden business, Story's Nursery.
What kind of clients do you serve?
Well, we have many different people who come to the greenhouse. Some are plant nerds and some are future plant nerds, particularly after they see some of the strange and unusual things we have. But really anyone interested in plants, especially succulents, love to visit our greenhouse. We welcome beginners and we welcome total plant nerds as well. The one thing that we ask, since we're a small business, is that you give us a call beforehand, 845-985-5071, and just make an appointment so that we'll be sure to be here when you come to visit.
How long have you been growing greenhouse plants?
There is a family picture of me in the greenhouse when I was 2 or 3 years old, patting the marigolds in the flat. So I've been growing plants for a long time.
Do marigolds like to be patted?
Yes, they do. You have to talk to them, too.
You gave me a nice tour of your garden before we started talking. Why did you plant so many gardens on your 2.5 acres?
Well, when we moved here, we had several pots of trees, shrubs, succulents, and they were all over the place at many people's greenhouses, backyards, etc., and we needed to get them here. We already had a wonderful garden to start with that the past owners, there's only been one owner of this home and garden, and it was such a beautiful home with different tiers of gardens. We could just imagine people walking through, so we created what we imagined, and it became reality. It's 2.5 acres, but it seems like so much more.
Did the previous owners have a garden there?
The previous owners basically had landscaping around the house, and they had, there's a big, big rock in the backyard. I think it came with the second glacier, but children love to be able to go up on it, stand on it, and play on it. So that was there with a garden, a long garden next to it with a few trees and shrubs. There's a whole lot more now.
But you have a greenhouse, so when did that go up?
Oh, but that came up before we did anything, because since our plants were all over several states and we had to get them all together, the first thing we did was build that greenhouse in October of 2012. And as soon as it was built, it was starting to get cold. The timing was perfect to get all the succulents from everywhere they were and other plants and get them to their new home here in Neversink.
John, did you design the layout of the garden?
Well, the present layout sort of develops piece by piece, year by year. This is a collector's garden, not a designer's garden. So when we saw a plant that we didn't have, we wanted to get it, and we found a spot. And so that means that if you see a plant that you want and don't have, you get it and stick it in the ground, you find a spot for it. So this ends up to be a very eclectic collection of plants.
General effect is very nice. What features does the garden include?
Well, there's a lot out there. There's an apple orchard. There is a blueberry patch with 22 high bush, early, mid-season, and late-season blueberry bushes. There's an alpine crevice garden. There's the Jurassic Park garden, where everything grows 3 times the size it should. There's a raspberry garden, a hydrangea garden. There's 3 tiers of perennial gardens. There's a mini hosta and fern garden, a pumpkin patch, and a deer-proof garden outside the deer fencing.
I would say, having walked through it, that the various gardens are separated by grass, and they are delineated by fencing or rocks. John, did you plan the paths and benches and other features as well as the planting?
Yes, we developed the walls and other features of the garden based on what was available here in the ground, stones to lay up again as a stone wall, and a little structure in the garden that was already here. So those kind of dictated where the garden was, how it developed.
Diana, are there water features?
Oh, although I've always wanted the look of Longwood Gardens and splashing fountains, we don't have really any water features, but we do have 2 really nice bird baths that are enjoyed by the birds and give our 2 cats some entertainment.
Diana, it looks to me as if you have kind of permanent gardens. Do you ever change the layout?
No, we add to the footprint. And, you know, when you're a gardener and you fall in love with plants, you just buy more and more and more. So we kind of call it shoehorn gardening.
Did you consider how you're going to be using the garden?
Yes, we had to figure out where our vegetable garden raised beds would be. We had to figure out what needed the most shade, what needed the most sun, and what needed to have its eyes on it more. So things are placed so that we can water them easily and that we could check on them daily.
Diana, are a lot of the plants perennials?
Well, outdoors, there's trees, shrubs, and flowering perennials, and they serve as the foundation of the garden design. There's interesting large containers filled with succulents that sit on rock walls. There's a cozy bench under a roof in the middle of the garden.
Do you pull up the plants then after they've bloomed and replace them with something else?
No, we will cut back blooms that are spent. We do have very early, mid-season, and late-season blooming varieties. And so there's always something to see in the garden, week by week, month by month, starting in late February and going till almost November.
Who does all the work? Who does all the weeding and the trimming? John? Well,
she'll tell you that she does, but I think that I do my share.
It's great exercise.
How often do you need to do that?
Well, I mean, we walk around the gardens daily. So if there's an annoying weed right in our face, we're going to pull it. But basically, we spend, I would say, about an hour or two a week together going from one garden to the other. They're well mulched and they're mature gardens. So there's really not much that has to be done once it's in and it's established and it's happy, watered, fertilized, and mulched, which keep the weeds down.
I guess I need to mulch. I think I spend 2 hours a day with my vegetables.
Oh, mulch. We shred our leaves in the fall, and then in the spring, once everything is up and the ground is warm, we'll put those leaves down about an inch to two around the plants, over the soil.
John, do you fertilize?
Well, in the greenhouse, we have a liquid feed system that puts fertilizer on every time if you need it, or sporadically if you don't. Outside in the garden, we fertilize a little bit, spot fertilize, but when you're putting on this beautiful compost, it's like black gold, and that puts so much nutrients on that we really don't need to fertilize a whole lot.
What kinds of fertilizer do you use?
Well, actually, the chemical fertilizer that's used in the garden is almost whatever you have on the shelf. 5-10-5, 10-10-10, 5-10-5, any of these are okay. But because it's chemical fertilizer, you have to do it carefully and sparingly. In the greenhouse, I don't fertilize anything in the greenhouse from basically October through April. And then starting in April, I put the injector so it fertilizes every time we water.
And Diana, how often do you water?
Well, when the skies don't provide us with the water we need, we turn the sprinklers on, and then we do have a can of water out there, seeing how much water is coming out from the sprinkler. As soon as we get to an inch of water in that can, we could turn the sprinklers off. And so that helps a lot. In the greenhouse, there are two water checks a day.
Are the sprinklers permanently placed?
No, we move them from garden to garden. In the greenhouse, there's two checks a day, particularly when it's very hot. Normally, once a day, we'll need to water flowering plants in the greenhouse, and the succulents are watered once a week. And then again, in the gardens, it depends on how much rain we get, if we need to add additional water.
It's been pretty dry this year. Do the succulents like that, or do you add water in any case?
Well, they're indoors, so they're not affected by the weather and the rain that we get. And outdoors, anything like our alpine garden that does have some succulent-type plants in it, it's very well-drained, so water is not going to sit, and it's not an issue.
John, do you have to contend with pests?
We don't allow pests on the property. Well, first of all, we practice integrated pest management. And the first line of defense for the little critters is our two cats, which keeps the mouse and vole and chipmunk population under control. But other insects that we have to contend with are treated with an organic application of neem, and we use BT for our cabbage and broccoli plants to keep the green worms off them.
And we use repellents to keep the deer away.
I did see a cabbage butterfly or two out there today, so you're not totally successful.
No, no one is.
What do you do if you get an invasion, for example, of Japanese beetles?
Well, Japanese beetles, we've had very good luck applying milky spore.
Okay. Milky spore.
Yeah. For pests like Japanese beetles, and it's a powder that you put in the soil and water it in, and then as the eggs are hatching and the young grubs are coming out and they start to feed, they actually eat the milky spore and they die from this disease that they get from it. So that's great. They never develop into the adults. And we found that the milky spore can last about 2 years. So we put down the powder in early spring every 2 years. And we've had good luck with keeping them at bay.
Have you ever had a die-off where you had to replace some plants?
We have the normal die-off of plants seasonally. Annuals, of course, start to go down in the fall. But we've never had a major die-off of any big group of plants because of any disease. Diseases that are specific to tomatoes have pretty much stayed on tomatoes. The diseases that are on the plants that get mildew pretty much are on those plants alone. So you know which ones are going to get something, and you treat them.
You treat the tomatoes?
Well, you can spray the tomato leaves with a copper mixture, which is available at your garden center, which counteracts the early blight and late blight on tomatoes, so you don't get the early defoliation of tomatoes, which keeps them from developing all their fruit.
What does it do to the tomatoes, the actual tomatoes?
It does not affect what you eat at all. You should always wash them, of course, but it's just a surfactant, a surface application, and it washes off easily. It doesn't make the tomato fruit look coppery. You can hardly see it.
Diana, have you ever overwatered?
I've overwatered, I've underwatered, and you learn from that experience. So in the greenhouse, basically most of our watering is by hose, and we're lucky to have two wells on the property. So one well runs 24/7, 365, and that's basically for the greenhouse and our home. And the other well is just a seasonal well for things like our vegetables and the outdoor display of plants that are for sale in the back of the greenhouse. A bit of advice I can give to people who are growing plants that are in pots, and it doesn't matter if it's a succulent or any type of plant. I learned many years ago that when a plant is dry, the water is going to come straight out the hole on the bottom. And every pot should have some holes on the bottom so the water can get out. But you water a plant the first time. When it's dry, the water, again, is going to come straight out the bottom. Wait until it comes out and it's all out. And then water it again slowly. The second time you water it, that water will absorb into all the soil in the pot and it will be perfectly watered. And then feel the weight of the pot. And you'll be able to just pick up a pot with time and say, this is light, this needs water. Oh, no, this still feels heavy. I think it's fine. You won't have to stick your finger in.
Diana, what plants do you have there? It looked to me like there was one of every kind of plants imaginable.
My name is Diana, his name is John, and we have a problem. Because we can't resist beautiful plants, and John can't resist propagating them. So we really do have plants from all over. Some plants are from John's mentor, Dr. Barad, who traveled mostly in Africa and South America, discovering many new cacti and succulents. And we go and know many people in the industry, so we trade off. You know, we have something they don't have, and then they give us something we don't have, and that's a good way to get plants as well.
John, can you list for me some of the plants that you have and what they look like?
Well, you have to remember that succulents are grown mostly for their form and shape, not so much the flowers, although they all will flower to some degree. But a couple of the big families that I have that I like especially, one is Euphorbia. Euphorbias are what poinsettias are by generic name. These are very small flowered ones, but native to South Africa and East Africa. There are several sucking up bromeliads that are interesting, being terrestrial growers, not epiphytic growers.
Diana, what are your favorites? You must have favorites.
I do have favorites. I like I love Aspidistra plants, that's for sure.
What are those?
Aspidistra is called a cast iron plant, and it's been around as a houseplant since the Victorian days because it could take low light. We have one called the Moon and the Stars that has these pretty white, look like moons and stars, on these long green leaves. They're very, very beautiful plants. Also, I like Swedish ivy. We make bonsais of them. Very easy to do, and they get thick trunks, and they really, really look interesting. And I also like a succulent called Abramediella, which is in the pineapple family.
And what does that look like?
Tell us all about your Abramediella.
Well, Abramediella is a member of the bromeliad group, and it looks like a bunch of little pincushion heads in a big mound, but if you grow it long enough, it can fill up a big pot to the extent there you can get to a 12 or even 16 inch pot. Very interesting and easy plant to grow.
Diana, what temperature do you keep the greenhouse at?
Well, with the price of oil and propane, and this is run by propane, we keep it between 40 and 60 degrees in the winter time, and that will suffice. We also do take some plants that do need warmer temperatures. We have a magnetic induction lighting in the basement of the house, and we bring plants in and put them under that lighting where it's warmer, more in the 60s.
Diana, I understand you're getting ready to retire. When will you close up shop, and will you be selling your plants at special prices?
Well, we are hoping to travel after December of this year, so we thought this would be a perfect time to let everyone know that we have some really incredible plants that will be sold at really incredible prices. We will be saving our special ones, which we will grow on, our large main specimens that we like to enter in different competitions, like the Connecticut Cactus and Succulent Society show each year in April. But yes, we're going to have great plants, great prices, starting in September until December 31st.
And then you're going to be gone for a while. How are you going to handle your plants while you're gone?
We're going to have staycations in some places that are not too far away. We're just very, very lucky to have dear friends who also have greenhouses that live nearby that can come and check on not only our greenhouse, but on our two kitty cats.
You may lose a few.
They're good. They're good.
Story's Never Sink Plant Company has an eclectic collection of plants for sale. They also keep several beautiful gardens. So now you know about Story's Never Sink Plant Company, a different kind of greenhouse in Never Sink, New York. My guests today have been Diana K. Wiener and John Story, owners and operators of that greenhouse business. If you'd like to suggest a local expert for me to interview, email me at stephanie@wjffradio.org. This has been Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country.
We hope that you enjoyed our show this week, with production by Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard, Stephanie Phillips, and myself, Rosie Starr. Special thanks goes to our guests, Diana K. Wiener and John W. Story, from their Never Sink Plant Company. Thanks for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill. Listen to us on air, on your smartphone, or stream us live at wjffradio.org. We are Radio Catskill. local news, culture, conversations, and NPR.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. Damascus Citizens.